Good morning. It is wonderful to be here. 40 years is a long time. And I look around this room and I see many faces that have grown up with me and are still growing. So it's good to be with you. When Bob first called me about this book and the topic, I was very thrilled. As many of you know, I've gone to Iona many times. I am an associate member of the community and follow their prayer life. And I had met John Philip Newell, and subsequently with Judith and the group of pilgrims last year, we had a wonderful encounter with him, which led to his being present here with all of us 2 weeks ago, which was an incredible experience. And as I've said to a number of you, he's the real deal. What you see is what you get, and I have found that to be true with all the members of the Iona community. It's a gathered and scattered community, which means people don't come and live and stay. It was Columba's idea in building and creating the monastery on Iona that it would always be a mission community that would come and be renewed and then head out. And that is still true today. And I think John Philip's a wonderful example of that. So when I was looking through the book and Bob suggested, well, what about November 14th? And I said, well, you know, that's great, Valentine's Day. And then I saw the chapter for today, Looking Suffering Straight in the Face. And it seemed kind of an ironic topic for Valentine's Day. And I thought, oh, man, it's going to be a downer for that group. But I've decided if we get to the heart of what Valentine's Day is truly about in the Christian faith, and in our culture, it's important that we're doing this topic on this day. Valentine's Day is a feast day in the church, the Christian church. It's a feast day to celebrate the Valentines. There were three martyrs in the Christian tradition by the name of Valentine in the 2nd and 3rd century. And as the story goes, and as we look at hagiography and mythology, we have to take all of this as truth that may not be true. One of the Valentines, as he was on his way to martyrdom, sent a note to one of his followers, kind of a love note. Not an Eros love note, but just a true love of my beloved. And at the end it said, and this comes to you, this note is from your Valentine. So moving forward, that feast day was celebrated in the church for centuries, and it really wasn't until Chaucer and his writing that we began to associate a romantic connotation to the festival. Now when we think about the icons of Valentine's Day, what comes to mind for me is Eros, the Greek god of love, and Cupid in the Roman pantheon. The myth of Cupid and Psyche is incredible. Well, Cupid, or Psyche, the god of desire, the god of love, sets the plan of romance in motion. But this character does so, and I think this is important for our day, with the symbols of the arrow and a torch. And those two symbols are there because they are the weapons in love of wounds and the inflammation inflaming the heart. So many of you know the myth of Cupid and Psyche. It's kind of a wonderful, I look at Don and I think he should be up here telling that story, because it's an incredible story of love and passion and challenge, and ultimately Psyche is revived at the end of her challenges placed by Venus with a kiss from Cupid. But the story doesn't end there. Well, I just wanted to say that we're going to be looking at a challenging topic, something very close to my spirit and my pilgrimage journey. And I think it's a good day to be looking at this. Well, you don't have to go very far to face suffering in our culture. Turn on the news, listen to NPR, and what do you find? Sandy Hook, Newtown, Connecticut, Aurora, Colorado, the Sikh temple in Wisconsin, 9/11. But we don't have to go that far either. Death, suffering and illness, divorce, the loss of jobs. I'm very fascinated with the role that indicator species, frogs, bees, prairie dogs, what they're telling us about the state of our environment. Their suffering assuages as a precursor to our own. Suffering, I have come to believe, and again today I want to put some things out there. Some of the work that I'm doing and the project that I'm kind of working on right now. I want to set these ideas out before you in the context of our chapter and get your feedback, your sense of things too. Because I've come to see suffering as certainly individual, communal, and spiritual. But I also have come to believe that no individual suffers alone. We are all part of communities, whether we know it or recognize it or not. My husband and I were talking about this because I said, I really don't think people suffer alone. And he said, well, what about homeless people? And what about, you know, people that no one cares for? And I said, but wait. And I remembered a story from my time working at Cottage. We had a homeless man who was brought to us in end-stage cancer. There was nothing to do but to care for him up on 6C. He had no one, but he had the nurses. And every day, those nurses who worked 10 and 12-hour shifts would say, don't you have somebody we can call? Don't you have somebody that we can let know you're here? And finally, one day, he said to a dear friend of mine, well, I do have some family in West Virginia, but I haven't seen them or spoken to them in 20 years. That nurse got on the phone and placed a phone call to the family member in West Virginia, found them. 2 days later, his 5 brothers and sisters were in that room. And they must have just picked up their duffels and have come because they didn't have, you know, they didn't bring sleepwear, they hadn't thought it all through, they just came. And we set them up in a room, the 6 of them sleeping together and using the shower, and we had a couple of the Cancer Festival t-shirts, and they slept in those, and he died in the presence of his siblings who took him home. I don't think anyone suffers alone. We think we do. But there's always, for me, and I would be interested in your response, this bigger community of which we are a part. Another aspect of suffering that John Philip introduces us to and does it so succinctly, but it's something that's been on my heart and I think connects to all the speakers that I've heard so far in this series, is it's spoken of differently. The sins of the fathers, our forebears. And for those of us who live in this country, I think it involves slavery. I think it involves 3,000 Native Americans who are buried at the old mission without a plaque. I think it involves the Holocaust. And I don't mean the only, but the Holocaust in Syria and in our midst. And I think we are part of that, that bigger suffering that's in our souls. Well, John Philip in this chapter poses a wonderful question. He says, will any of our struggles change if we avoid looking at suffering directly and compassionately, that is with passion. And I was really struck by that little addendum. He could have just left it with the question mark, but he says, that is passion. And here again, I think we need to go to the definition of passion. Passion is important, and we use that word a lot in the Christian community. But where does it come from? What does it really mean? In Middle Latin, the derivative of passion is passio, which means the sufferings of Christ. That's the first definition you find for passion in most dictionaries. It will go on to talk about passion is a powerful emotion and feeling. It involves suffering, submission, and fervor. But again, we come back to that first definition. Passion is about the sufferings in the Christian tradition. It speaks deeply to the sufferings of Christ. I was very pleased in this chapter that Newell brings forth the story of Etty Helsam, who many of you, I'm sure, have read her collection of her journals that were put together in a book, The Interrupted Life. It's an amazing journey she makes through the study of psychology, the Christian faith, her Judaism, to end up working in a transport station, helping people get on the trains one day a week to go to their deaths. And in that, in the midst of that, she says, and this is where he gets our title for today, I try to look at things straight in the face, even the worst of crimes. And in her journal, she highlights the bird she sees or the flower, or she, in the midst of so much pain and suffering, there's always the beauty, the wonder. Well, Newell suggests that in our technological age, we have distanced ourselves both from the depth of the pain and the depth of the beauty in the midst of suffering. And that has certainly been my experience. I'm not a Pollyanna. I've been in the circles of grief and loss and pain, and I know there aren't easy answers. But I do believe that we can hold those things, in my experience, in my life, both the beauty and the suffering. Well, I think I'd like to focus on three questions that came out of this chapter for me and explore them a little more deeply. One, which I've alluded to, when we look suffering straight in the eye, how are we able not only to see the experience of life's pain, but also of life's beauty? How do we hold those things? Who helps us to hold those things? The second question is very profound for me personally. How do we carry within us the life of those who have gone before us, our forebears? Newell alludes to and has told beautiful stories to this group about his father and grandfather, and realizing with some neck pain and the help of a Reiki practitioner that he may be holding the wounds of his father and grandfather. It's a credible story in this chapter. So how do we do that? And as members of the human family, and that part that we carry in us that is broken, that brokenness, how do we hold that? And lastly, and this is most important for me, and really grows out of my experience of interfaith work, my time with Sikhs learning Kundalini Yoga, how are we to be part of the healing of suffering? Spiritual traditions call us to service and action. So in the midst of that, how do we respond? And I believe we can all be instruments for healing. Well, due to the bereavement work that I've been doing for the last 15 years with the Archdiocese, which I love, I'm the only non-Catholic on the teaching team, And Sam Frias, who's the deacon who facilitates our program, always says, and now I want to introduce the Reverend Susan Copeland. In the early days, there was silence, but more, more and more, there's this, yay! And from men as well as women. And I have to say, we do a series every year with the new deacons, and they're the most radical end. At least that's my experience so far. So this work has gently but firmly nudged me to continue to look at my life. And now the communities that I come in contact that are dealing with grief and healing. And for me, this is about pilgrimage. In many cases, I've needed intentionally to place myself in a place where there has been suffering. I need to go there. I need to see it. I need to touch it. I need to be part of it. And that's where I want to go first. So how do we look suffering in the face? I was scheduled to teach a unit in this bereavement course on, we call it Children and Suffering and How Children Grieve and Grieving Children. And the Saturday before I was to teach this class, the shootings happened at the Safeway in Tucson on January 8th, 2011. All of us watched that terrible incident graphically documented on our televisions and on the radio. But my heart, in the midst of all of that, and because I had next week, I was going to be teaching this class on children, I was particularly moved by the story of Christina Taylor Green. She was the 9-year-old who had recently been elected to the student council at her elementary school, and she went with a neighbor, a very good friend, to meet Gabriella Gifford at the Safeway. She made a list of questions. She was bright and eager. And actually, if you could put the first slide up, there she is. She was right up at the front, one of the first shot. The neighbor who went with her was wounded. And the story really moved my heart. And so in the next 2 days, I tried to read as much as I could and learn as much as I could in the hopes that there might be something in her story, something in this experience that could speak to our gathering, our class on bereavement. And one of the first things I learned, which was kind of a little hidden detail, and it came up in one of the newspaper articles I read online, is that family friends had called New Millery Abbey in Dubuque, Iowa, and asked the monks there, who are casket makers, to offer a casket to the family. I'd never heard of New Millery Abbey. I didn't know about the Trappist casket makers. So needless to say, I had a lot of research to do. You see, the monks at New Millery Abbey outside Dubuque, where Judith went to college, in addition to keeping holy hours, farming, maintaining a retreat center, they build caskets. And they call it the Trappist caskets. You can find it online. It's an incredible website. They have committed, as part of their mission, to providing a casket for any family that suffers the death of a child. They believe that crafting caskets for a child is a corporal work of mercy. So I found myself, after going online and reading this prayer that I will share with you, making immediately a contribution to the casket fund for children. It's just an incredible ministry. And this is the prayer that they offer. They bless every casket before it goes. It's in traditional language, but it just moved me so deeply. I thought of Christina's casket receiving this blessing before it was sent. Merciful Father, by your Son's suffering and death and rising from the dead, we are freed from death and promised a share in your divine life. By the hands of monks each day, raised in praise of your goodness, This casket was fashioned for your child who died in faith. We ask you now to bless this casket. Receive the soul of our departed sister who is laid in this humble bed as in a cradle. Safe in your care until the day of resurrection, when we will all be reunited in the vision of your glory. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, one God, forever and ever. Amen. Well, as I read about their work and these blessings and their commitment to sustainability of the environment, they use the trees on their property. They mill them to make these caskets. And they also, and this was amazing to me, every casket they make, they go out in the woods and they dedicate a tree for the person that has died. And they bless the tree. The trees are usually planted in the early spring. I knew I needed to make a pilgrimage to this place. I had to go there. My dear husband said, okay. I'd never been to Dubuque before. We'd driven through Iowa, so it truly was a pilgrimage. And in my writing, I talk about the first stage of pilgrimage is longing. I had such a longing, and I knew I had to go. So, oh, there it is. I got on a plane and flew to Chicago and then got on another little plane. And journeys are important in pilgrimage. And went to Dubuque. It's a very little airport. And when I arrived, one of the brothers was there to pick me up and took me to the Abbey. You can do the next one. Just across the road, and you can see this is rural Iowa. It's not a fancy place. It's a lot of rolling cornfields, and they're beautiful forests. And my goal initially was to go on a tour of their Trappist casket making. So I made an appointment and went across the road and met Brother Felix. And Brother Felix was my tour guide on the through the factory. Now, this is not a factory in the way we would often think of a factory. Actually, Brother Felix is standing at his workstation. He does assemblage of these caskets in their early stages. Everybody has a station. Some of the monks who are keeping silence work in an area up above. It's a little bigger than this room, and then there's a glassed area, so they don't speak. But Brother Felix was a pretty social kind of guy, and I was the only one on the tour, so he was proud to show me his where he works. And then he took me around, and he introduced me to all the people who were working. This woman, Elaine, has been working in the factory for many years. Her job is the finish staining. She came over and spoke to me, and Felix had already told me that her son had died, and they had made a casket for him. He was a young adult in an automobile accident. And I'd asked about the trees, and he said, oh, yeah, we'll go out and see his tree. And then Elaine said to me, I hope you will pray for me. I've had a recurrence of cancer, and I really need as much prayer as I can get. Now, do you think that happens in most places? I mean, these people were so connected. She was bold to say, I need prayer. I don't know you, but you seem nice enough, and will you pray for me? And I felt that all along. The interiors of the caskets are padded with some material from a factory that used to discard the filling. It's a foam. But the monks got a great deal. They're recycling this material and using it in their caskets. Their caskets, as you can see, are beautiful. They also design urns and ship them all over the country. Felix was proud to tell me that Maria Shriver had ordered caskets for her mother and father from them. And celebrity doesn't matter in the casket business, but I think he felt his ministry in that. So then I went outside and I said, you know, I came all this way because I have to see Christina's tree. And of course, they all, the brothers, knew about her. And he took me out to this area, and this is Christina's tree. It looks, this is, you know, just at the end of winter, so it's a little barren, and it had been planted just the time before. But under it was this plaque. And I when I stood there prayerfully, I thought, someday, when I meet her parents, I want to share this story with them. Do they know what has happened in their name? Well, that was a wonderful experience, and while I was with the brothers, I knew at some point I had to go to Tucson. And that's what pilgrimage can do for you. You make a journey, you get some insights, and it doesn't end there. As a matter of fact, when you walk the Camino de Santiago in Spain, and you come to the cathedral at the end of your journey, on the south portico of the cathedral, the earliest portico of the cathedral, way high up are the letters, the Alpha and Omega. But at Santiago, they're reversed. The Omega is first, and the Alpha is second. Now, this was constructed in the 1100s. And yet, the vision even at that time was, when we end a journey, we're beginning. We're just beginning. And I felt that in this experience at New Millery. So I needed to go to Tucson. And fortunately, we have friends there. I have a clergy friend there. And they both made it accessible to us to have some encounters with people along the journey. And yet, with true pilgrimage, we never know what's going to come. And what I found there, although my focus was on Gabby Giffords and Christina Taylor Green, there was so much more that happened. The first place we went, I had read about Green Field, and this is at a baseball park in Tucson. Christina's father worked for the LA Dodgers. He's a recruiter. And when the National Baseball League heard about her death, they raised a lot of money and they wanted to do something in her memory. So at this baseball field is this beautiful sign, I'd heard about it, dedicated to her. When we arrived, kids were arriving to have games, which is incredible. And part of the other thing I wanted to see there, I'd heard about, was something called the Angel in the Field. And there's an artist who, again, from her commitment to suffering and beauty, at least from my point of view, she makes these beautiful metal brass angels. This stands about 10 feet high on a stone base. And she shows up and puts them at places like the Pennsylvania field where the plane went down, or where there's been a shooting. It's a beautiful, beautiful memorial. And it's just down from the sign. Well, I was taking pictures and I saw a woman sitting on a bench kind of looking down at the kids playing. It was very poignant because Christina had played there. And her brother played there. And I was bold to say, you know, how are you doing? This is what I'm here for. And do you know about this? And how has the community dealt with it? And she looked at me and she said, we're a very tight community. We have struggled with this. It is difficult. My son plays with Christina's brother. And Christina's father coaches my son. You know, it's all the 6 degrees, how about 2 degrees of separation? She said, it has been difficult and challenging, but we love our children and we love our community and we're tight. And as I came to know Tucson over that week, it really is a tight community. Santa Barbara's a tight community. But Tucson, I think because the environment is so insular, you got to go a long way to get to Tucson. And when you get there, people are connected. So, again, though I went to focus on Christina and Gabby, I learned so much more. One of the things that happened after the shootings was something called A Day of Healing for Our Children. And it was put together by the interfaith community. It was put together by a small hospice for children only called Tu Netito. the little blanket, the little cuddle. It's a wonderful place where children, just children, can go for spiritual support and healing. And it was going to be held at a UCC church, a United Church of Christ church. So I got all this information, and the first place I went was to visit with the woman who'd spearheaded it. She's a young Presbyterian pastor at a very famous church in Tucson, the Sanctuary Church. Her church was the prime mover of the sanctuary movement that has helped people that are coming off the desert, that are trying to get into this country. And one of the things I found there, oh, this is from Tunatito. They have a wonderful beading program, and the children can make necklaces and bracelets. And this one says, tell your story, honor your grief. And they have different beads for the first year, the second year, a lot of different ways for children to be about their healing. But in the sanctuary church in the heart of Tucson is this memorial. I don't know if you can see it very clearly, but it's a piece of stone embedded with the footprints of the people who make that walk across the desert to get into this country. And at the base of it are stones. And one of the things the sanctuary church and the movement do is go out in the desert and put containers of water so that people who are coming across can get water. They put out shoes and first aid equipment. They do this regularly in conjunction with many churches. But one of the other things they do is remember those who have died. And some of the people that are died, there's a stone for every person. They get the names from the city every year, but they also put a stone for the unnamed ones. And discovering in the midst of this incredible environment, here was a church not only concerned about the healing of the children in Tucson, but regularly supports the forgotten ones. And here's one of the stones for someone. They never discovered their name. They never knew who they were. Well, she sent me to another church, a Roman Catholic church, which is very involved with this project as well. And this is on the side of the church. It's a cross made out of cactus from the desert. And again, they have crosses with the names and those who are unnamed. And it's a shrine of sorts. It faces a beautiful labyrinth. It's a very, very powerful, beautiful thing. And actually, I have a picture up in the crossbeams of that cross were two dove nests. Can't see them very well without a zoom. But here in the midst, again, of the suffering was beauty. She also sent me to Westminster Presbyterian Church, big church in Tucson. At that church, there was a woman killed at the Safeway and a gentleman wounded. And I had an appointment with the minister, and we talked about suffering and communal healing, and I said something to the effect of, how has that been for you? What was that like? And he said, oh, Susan, you don't understand. We know about suffering here. 2 years ago, our organist, beloved in the community, was brutally murdered and found in a ditch. He said, we know. We're a tight community. Then I went to the UCC church where the Day of Healing had been held. You can see all these zigzags going here. The UCC church, United Church of Christ Church, is just down the road, maybe a block from the Safeway. The minister wasn't in, they're in transition, but I talked to the church secretary and, you know, how did it go? What was your involvement? And she said, well, we really didn't have a lot to do with it, that we didn't have any victims. And I'm thinking, gee, you're just up the block. And we talked. She was very welcoming, but there wasn't a lot there. And so as I began to leave, she followed me out to the car. She said, I think you need to come back in, which I did. And she took me into her office, and there had been two gentlemen out in the front who'd heard our conversation that were folding the bulletins for Sunday. And she said, Bob C. said, maybe I do have something to share with you. She said, we know about suffering. 2 years ago, our minister here committed suicide. It was very unexpected. He was very beloved. He was having some psychological issues that no one knew about. She said, I was the secretary and I didn't know. We know about suffering. We're a tight community. And one last piece of this, I hadn't planned to go to the Safeway. It just felt like too holy ground for me. But we were so close, and I thought, come on. I got there, and one of the first things I noticed, there's no plaque, there's no signage, and I walked into this Safeway, and people were shopping. They were walking around, putting things in their cart, and my first thought was, oh my gosh, what's wrong with you people? There's been a tragedy here. Please, somebody. And, you know, I calmed myself down, and I felt moved to see if I could talk with the manager. And he came out, a lovely man, and I said, you know, I'm here doing this research, and I wonder if you can tell me anything about your experience with that. And did he talk? He said, I can't tell you how proud I am of the employees of this place. When the shooting started, they dropped their work and ran out. And they were the first there to provide CPR, even before the paramedics arrived. He said, I'm so proud of our team. And he said, I'm also proud of the way Safeway has taken care of us. They closed the store, they gave employees time off, and he said, we still have two or three employees that are getting help, psychological help. We don't have a Safeway in Santa Barbara, but I was impressed. I would go there now. You know, they cared about, they had a special liaison person assigned to them, all of that. And then he said, and then there is my son. And he said, my son went to school with Christine. He knew her. And, you know, a memorial had grown up at that site, as often happens. And he said, when it had been there for a time, and there were ceremonies, and it was time to let go of it. And on the 2 days before they were going to remove the materials, he said, my son came with a note, and it was addressed to Christine. And he said, the dad said, do you want to let me see it or share it with me? He goes, no. So he put it on the memorial. Several days later, a group of volunteers, including employees, began the process of archiving all that material. And this is something I didn't know at these memorial sites. Happened in Aurora, happened at the Seat Place, I'm sure it's happening in Newtown. All that stuff, books, cards, bears, everything, is boxed by the victim. And archived, in the case of Tucson, at the University of Tucson, has archived all that material so that years from now, if a family member wants to go and retrieve it or have it, they can. And he said, I was helping with that, and I found the note my son had sent. And I said, well, what did you do? He said, I opened it. I read it. And he didn't tell me what it said, but he said, I said, did you keep it? I'm a mother, you know, I'm thinking down the road, what a wonderful thing. He said, no, it wasn't addressed to me. It's an 8-year-old. It was addressed to Christina. And I put it back and I put it in the box with her things. So many people in Tucson are healing from the suffering of that shooting, building a network of support and hope in the midst of great suffering. It's a healing community. It's a community that has looked suffering in the face, right up close and personal, and also seen beauty. Well, the other question, second question, was how do we carry within us the life of those who've gone before, our forebears, and hold that brokenness? When Biff and I were newly engaged, we made a trip with his mother and father to Alabama. I'd never been to the South, never traveled there, And part of the reason we went was to meet the folks where his family members are from. But also, I have to admit, to attend the National Football League Championships in New Orleans, because Biff is a graduate of Notre Dame, and Notre Dame was in the finals that year and won. It was great. But I'm a California girl. I grew up in Whittier and in a liberal Protestant church. And at 22, I was very naive. Biff's relatives took us around town, and they were proud to show us their Presbyterian church. And, oh, yeah, and the Black Presbyterian church that's over here. And the shops downtown. And, oh, yeah, these are the shops for the Black community. And they didn't say that word. They didn't use that word. And, oh, and here are the schools. And those are the Black schools over there. I was stunned. I was shocked. I'd never experienced anything like that before. And Biff had two uncles that were proud to say they had stood at the bus station when the Freedom Riders came through in the 60s with bats in hand to keep them from getting off the bus. I was just, I didn't know. They were so proud of it, and I realized even then that now I was part of that too. I was part of it too. Now, I want you to know we did get married. We came back from Alabama. We got married. We've been married almost 39 years, so something worked. But that wound has stayed with me, and I didn't know what to do about it. I didn't know how to heal it. And every time the words Black or African American or prejudice or anything have come through, it's been there, that deep wound. Now, my family's not from Alabama. I grew up in a liberal Protestant Presbyterian church, and yet it was my wound, too, as I have felt the wounds of the Holocaust and the wounds of slavery and whatnot. Well, in the spring of 1989, we were up at Berkeley. Biff was on sabbatical, and I was finishing my MDiv at Pacific School of Religion. And one of my classes required us to visit churches in the greater Bay Area. We had a number of assignments. And I had a friend and colleague from Iceland, Vikfus Arnison, who really took this to heart. And he says, we've got to get out. We've got to, in this charming Icelandic way, we've got to really get out and do something different. So he decided we should visit Allen Temple in Oakland. Now, Allen Temple is, at that time, and I'm sure it's still the truth, was known for its vibrant worship, its incredible preachers, and its service to the Black community in that particular, it's in really the heart of the Black community. This Allen Temple Baptist Church was organized in 1919 as a storefront by a missionary, Reverend Allen. It was originally located on the corner of East 14th and Seminary Avenue in East Oakland. And then in the 80s and 90s, under the leadership of the Reverend Dr. Alfred Smith, it became a huge community, thriving place with over 5,500 members, and it's still doing very well today. Well, Vikfus was very amiable. He's a very friendly kind of guy. So we arrive at the church, we go in, and he immediately introduces us to the ushers as seminarians. Oh, they said, well, come right in. And they ushered us down to the front row. I like the front row, but I thought, you know, this could we just hide out here a little bit? There was no hiding out. We were the only white people in the whole congregation. And as this was happening in the church, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of people. The clergy come in, and as part of the welcome, they asked us to stand and recognize us and say how great it is we're there. And then Reverend Smith introduces the preacher for the day, the Reverend Ray Copeland. He wasn't white. I wanted to run. I wanted to leave that place. Everything that had happened to me years before in Alabama was just right there, viscerally. And I didn't know what to do. Well, he preached a wonderful sermon. He was from Chicago. Spelled his name just like us. And at the end of the service, Reverend Smith came to our row and invited both of us to recess with the clergy and stand in the reception line. And who did I stand by? Reverend Ray Copeland. I immediately told him how wonderful his sermon was, and but it was an awkward moment for me. It didn't seem to be for him, but it felt that wound was so open and raw. And then as we stood there, Vic Foos from Iceland, Susan from Santa Barbara, the Reverend Ray Copeland from Chicago, and others, we were greeted one by members of that congregation. People shook my hand and looked me in the eye and said, "We're so glad you're here. We're so happy to meet you. We hope you'll come again." And in that moment, something shifted deep within me. Some of the woundedness and the shame that I carried from our forebears was healed. Well, it's not over in that healing. In May, Biff and I are going to Alabama to the 100th anniversary of the Copeland Community Presbyterian Church. You see, Biff's grandfather was a Presbyterian minister in Athens, Alabama. And we've been learning more and more about all that. And we will be there with members of the family. And right down the road is Copeland Cemetery, and it's on Copeland Avenue. It used to be called Possum Trot. But after he preached a mission there, the community was so moved, they named it the Copeland Community and Copeland Presbyterian Church. So I'm not done. We're not done with the healing and the woundedness and perhaps some of the shame that we may learn more about. But it's coming along. I saw the beauty in the midst of my suffering that Sunday. I know the beauty in the midst of that suffering. And that's something I think God invites us all to. Well, quickly, the last... maybe we should take our break. And maybe when we come back, I do want to briefly talk about how we can be part of the healing. And I do want to speak to that. Is that all right, Judith? Okay, thank you.